Welcome, everyone. This is Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice, and I'm Terry Patton, the creator and host of this series. For those who don't already know me, I'm also the founder and teacher of Integral Spiritual Practice and the author of Integral Life Practice with Ken Wilber. I convened this teleseminar series to serve the evolution of consciousness and culture by creating a deep public dialogue about how spiritual practice and higher levels of consciousness can play a key role in helping human beings rise to the challenges of our world crises, to make as benign as possible a transition to a sustainable human presence on our planet. And I've held a series of profound and enlivening conversations on this topic with many of today's leading spiritual teachers and thought leaders. And once you've registered at beyondawakeningseries.com, they're all available for free download at beyondawakeningseries.com/blog. This morning, I'm happy to be joined by Diane Musho Hamilton and Jeff Salzman to continue that discussion in a conversation entitled Cosmic Creativity and Integral Genius. The way this will work is that I'll introduce Diane and Jeff and we'll dialogue for about an hour, and then I'll make some announcements and we'll spend about a half hour taking your questions and we'll finish up in about 90 minutes. Diane Musho Hamilton is an exceptionally gifted mediator, group facilitator, and one of the leading teachers of integral spirituality. Diane is a Zen priest and teacher, receiving Dharma transmission from Genpo Roshi in 2006. She's worked with Ken Wilber and the Integral Institute since 2004. With extraordinary humor, warmth, depth, and insight, she encourages us to consciously evolve beyond old and limited ideas of who we are so that we might discover our own unique expression of wisdom and compassion in this time. Jeff Salzman worked for 3 years with Ken Wilber in developing the Integral Institute, specifically seminars on integral applications to business, psychology, and spirituality. And he currently teaches at Boulder Integral and leads its flagship offering, the Integral Incubator, a 5-day in-residence program designed to help people get traction on the calling of their lives. He also authors The Daily Evolver, a blog and weekly audio podcast in which he looks at current events through an integral lens. Jeff co-founded Career Track Training, an adult education company he and his partner built into an international organization producing over 3,000 seminars annually and employing over 300 people. He's a longtime practitioner in several philosophical and spiritual traditions. Jeff has taught Buddhist meditation and led many retreats. And full disclosure, the three of us are good friends and colleagues from our years of working closely together at Integral Institute, and we're working together again now. So thanks so much for being with us here. Jeff, I think Diane is a little late for the call. I expect her any second. I'm really happy to have you here with me today.
It's great to be here, Terry. We have just spent the weekend together working on our next project, the Integral Spiritual Experience, coming up over the holidays, New Year's. So
yeah, we should talk about
left,
that.
We just left.
Yeah, we did. We just said goodbye yesterday.
Yeah.
I think it would be kind of good for us to begin by kind of opening up this topic of cosmic creativity and how it's relevant to rising to meet the challenges of the world in crisis. But maybe it'd be good to start off with some words about genius as well. I mean, Jeff, do you have any orienting comments on those topics and what they have to do with how we're going to meet these obviously intense evolutionary challenges that the whole human race is facing right now?
Right, indeed. Well, just that, you know, one of the things I'm learning and one of the things is sort of at the edge of my own practice is locating, as Ken would put it, the echo of the Big Bang inside my own mind-body. And to just notice that, you know, the cosmos is a creative act just by definition and is not, and it shows no sign of stopping. You know, it just continues to get more complex and capable and aware and conscious and now of itself. And we can find that in our own being. and work with that as a practice. And it sort of, on one hand, gives us new commitment and to, you know, really put the rubber to the road and work on what we're here to do, which is ever more clear as we get in touch with that. And on the other hand, it also invites us to relax and realize that we're being lived and that we can actually just unfurl our sails to the updraft of emergence itself. And that we're playing on those, in those sort of two sides of the street of intention and surrender to really express ourselves into the world. And I just am thrilled. We were at Ken's yesterday. He said a comment. I said, Ken, I'm bodily thrilled by that. And I am at this point. That's just the edge of my own practice and realization. And so, you know, it's an honor to be here talking to you about it and to be working with you on it, Terry.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, this idea of seeing you is an interesting idea. I think most of the folks listening have read the blurb, but just to make it explicit, it's a term that Brian Eno coined a few years back to connote the genius of a whole scene. A lot of us had, you know, it was a wonderful movie earlier this year, Midnight in Paris, in which the special liveliness of the Paris salons that Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Toklas was being celebrated, but in which the fact that we're always looking back to these great creative scenes of the past, the Belle Epoque, the Bloomsbury Group, Silicon Valley, Building 20 at MIT, the kind of intensity that was there way back, say, in Venice during the early Renaissance in the House of Medici, that there's a kind of creativity that arises when a whole group of people are participating together in that scene in which there's mutual appreciation and risky moves are applauded by the whole group and subtlety is appreciated and friendly competition kind of goads everyone forward. Kevin Kelly wrote about this, I thought, very eloquently, identifying how there's a rapid exchange of new insights and new tools and new techniques, and there are network effects because we all feel like we're in on the same thing together, and there's a local tolerance for novelties that rather than the pushback that the general culture gives. If you've got a scene that's alive, that there's at least a local group of people that kind of get the adventuresome edge that you're pressing, and you're not always having to kind of push back against the resistance of people in general. And that combination of things really creates amazing opportunities for creative breakthrough. And one of the things that I think we're seeing right now in the integral and evolutionary scenes is that this creative breakthrough that has been happening periodically throughout time has been happening with more and more rapidity, and that we're inheriting kind of the convergence of a whole bunch of them that have been going on. There's a whole rich community around non-dual spirituality. There's a rich community around evolutionary ideas. There's a rich community around the integral breakthroughs and theoretical connections, and they're converging. And this kind of convergence of these scenes is itself exciting, and it's bringing something really electric forward for all of us.
Right. No, it's so true, and it's one of the things that we noticed when we were doing the seminars at the Integral Institute is that, you know, the seminar would be on integral life practice, or it would be on psychology, or it would be on business or leadership or whatever was the topic, and that would be a wonderful part of the program. And invariably, at the end of these 5 or 6 day workshops, people would say that equally valuable, if not more so, was they just got to be with their tribe. You know, they got to be with other people who get them and for whom and with whom they don't have to edit. They don't have to put a lid on. They don't have to dampen down anything. They can say what they think. They can receive and see and be seen in a way that is just, you know, not only delicious, but also calls forth higher genius. It just calls forth higher capacity because there's capacity for it in the group. And that is, you know, happening more and more, and not only in terms of conferences and like the Spirit ISE coming up in New Year's and all of that good stuff, but on these calls and in the various ways that people are connecting virtually. And I know you're on board with this, Terry, because you're doing it so much and so successfully. But I haven't necessarily been, and I've been on a couple conferences and virtual calls and this sort of thing lately in a way that I'm getting that we've crossed the certain technology barrier where there is real seniness going on in these moments. And I'm just thrilled by it. And I would notice, too, that seniness happens you know, you could clearly see seniors or that group genius of in a jazz band. I was just listening to the music before the call here and just thinking about however many musicians it was playing that music, five or six, or it had to be, that they were joined in a moment together. And there was something in that moment that just called forth a beauty and a coherence and a genius that was, you know, beautiful. And you see that with sports teams and so forth. But then there's another seniors, and this is the one you were talking about, like Paris in the 20s, where there's just a group of people of like minds who are creating a moment, you know, you might say a capital M moment, that it transcends, you know, just this moment or that moment, but is just a place and a time where new ideas are being birthed into a space that is able to receive them and accommodate them and work with them. And it's very mutually inspiring and mutually reinforcing to be in that kind of a situation. And I see more and more of it happening, and this calls an example.
Absolutely. I think that one of the things that is going on in the group of people who listen to these Beyond Awakening broadcasts, Jeff, is that there's varying degrees of concern about the larger world, the financial crises, the environmental crises, the whole pattern with terrorism and WMD and proliferation and all of that, you know, bear on people tremendously. And they want to make a contribution, and yet the difficulty of an individual to having some really effective relevance to these huge, larger patterns, you know, is often daunting. And so we've had a lot of very rich conversations about, well, how do we respond and what is it that is responsible, you know, engagement? And we've had people on who simply direct us into the present moment, into that non-opposition, simply open, transparent, open-hearted, loving relationship to the present moment. And that only in that mode are we really able to be true. And to radiate a different kind of clarity and simplicity through which a whole different organizing principle can make its way into the world. Whereas other people have advocated for very engaged, very active, outward activism. Join with the folks in Occupy Wall Street. Get out there. Really try to interrupt the patterns, because the human race does seem to be caught in its own trance and is sleepwalking into some serious disasters. And as somebody who's watching current events as intensively as you are, looking at it through an integral lens, and then looking at what's generating in terms of creativity, and this whole consideration we've been having on cosmic creativity, which really has to do with how something novel enters into a pattern that is moribund. What are your current thoughts? Where are your hopes and fears? What is it that, and how does this whole consideration of cosmic creativity and the vibrancy of this integral seniness that we're participating and serving, how can that have an impact on such a huge scale?
Well, I think that what we're called to do as integralists, as evolutionaries, is to, you know, take our seat in our highest potential. And that means that we want to, from an integral perspective, take our seat in second tier, teal, turquoise, and recognize that even just basic integral theory shows us that one of the main markers of first-tier structures, that is green, orange, blue, amber, and so forth, versus the second tier, is that first tier is motivated by fear. Second tier is motivated by expression, creativity, engagement. And that's a very different move. And so I think one of the things that we need to engage is fear itself, to use a phrase from Roosevelt, and realize that there is no shortage of things to be afraid of, and economic and weapons of mass destruction and contagions and global warming and even asteroids and whatever it may be, and that there never has been any shortage of things to be afraid of, and that there's always a story running that is hooks into our hypervigilant nervous system that has been so powerful for us, particularly in moving up into first-tier structures themselves. And so every first-tier structure has some fall-from-paradise story, some story about how we human beings drove this world into a ditch, and here we are, and aren't we screwed up, and isn't this awful, and this shouldn't be happening, and it's awful that it is, and I can't stand it, and somebody needs to be punished, and somebody needs to be blamed. And you notice that they all have a story about how it's going to work once everybody sees the world the way they do. When the world, everybody accepts Jesus, or the 13th caliphate is reinstalled. That's the traditionalist view. The modernist view is once everybody becomes rational and just sees things clearly, then that'll be the solution. And Green has its story, the postmodern story of once everybody sees that there's, no absolute truth, and that all things are relative, and they just get it, that getting it that happens in Green. And that there is always some story of despair. And I think at second tier, we want to challenge that itself. We want to challenge that whole storytelling itself and see that one of the things that's also clear about looking at history is that even though all of history has been an ongoing catastrophe and continues to be, it's an evolving catastrophe. And we can actually take some heart in seeing that human beings are now living more decent, longer, healthier lives than ever before in history. Are there problems? Are there setbacks? Is any given decade always, lockstep progress? No. But the bigger view from the higher altitude absolutely is. We have more food, we have more lumens, we have more antibiotics, we have more lifespan, we have more communication, we have more indoors, we have more clothing, we have more travel, we have more entertainment, we have more education, we have more opportunities to be with each other. The last thing we want to do is integralists. And one of the things that we want to push off of as something other than postmodern is we want to push off that sort of intrinsic, reflective, mechanical despair that human beings have been carrying for a long time and actually take some juice and pleasure and heart in the fact that human beings, we're working our way out of the muck, and we're actually doing it. And I would add that one of the problems with even suggesting such a thing, and things aren't so bad. Actually, things are getting better. Try that at your next dinner party with your liberal friends. I mean, people not only just are aghast, they're angry at that view. And there's an anger that I think actually comes out of the fear of letting go of fear. Because we wonder, and I know this is my practice, as I move into second tier and start making friends with everybody, where's my juice? If I'm not angry and victimized and fearful, then what's going to motivate me to get off the couch? And I would argue that one of the practices that we need to engage as serious evolutionary practitioners is to see what is it that characterizes the motivations of second tier, and that actually cosmic creativity is at the core of it, that we realize that we are here to express ourselves, We are here to help each other. We are here to give each other heart and to fix the problems and to celebrate the successes and, you know, not be afraid. And so that's where I'm working. That's my practice, and that's my work these days.
Well, good. I think we've stirred the pot really, really usefully. But how does cosmic creativity have, where does the theme here of our call of cosmic creativity and integral genius, how is that optimistic, fundamental faith in evolution not only a way of calming down, but a way of generating something new? Obviously, that's the theme of what we're talking about here, and us coming together to generate something new in ways that are dynamic. So maybe a mood that has a fundamental appreciation for the general benign nature of the directionality of cultural evolution. But, you know, there can be horrible disasters. I mean, in the meantime, you can exterminate 6 million Jews. In the meantime, the whole integral and evolutionary communities could come to grief. So,
yes.
You know, much of what we do cherish and love is not guaranteed to have, you know, in some sense, this is all contextualized by the universality of loss and death. And there's a sobriety
that's
appropriate, too.
When I would add that, and then that's one of the spiritual dimensions that is required, or spiritual competencies, if you will, is that we have to get that, you know, at second tier, we actually do get, I think, that we are unmoored from an ideology that is cozy and makes us think that we have it figured out and makes us feel safe. And we realize that we are, oh my God, it takes your breath away. We are riding on this updraft of emergence that is still catastrophic in any given corner of the room. You know, that is a practice. That calls for a capital R realization where we can still be alive and effective and truly helpful, instead of gripped and angry and contracted around who should be blamed and what's gone wrong here, that I think it really releases, you know, what we're after. And I think a lot of it, when you talk about, you know, where's the cosmic creativity fit in and all of that, it's fundamental in the sense that it is that quickening of our hearts, that part of our calling that's actually located in the body. You know, where you have a sense of where you need to go and what you need to do and what you want to pay attention to, because when you do, you light up. And when you don't, you feel deadened and numbed. And that is, you know, that's good practice to start noticing those kinds of signals and those kinds of, you know, manifestations in our own mind bodies. And so, you know, for me, the thing that makes me happiest is talking about the things that I'm talking about right now. I am as happy as a guy like me can be in this moment, because I have the opportunity to talk to people who have an ear to hear about something that I think is a realization that I've had that I want to share. And, you know, it's kind of like nothing can stop me from doing that, you know, except a Boulder dinner party.
Diane, you're here. We're so
yeah, I've been here for a little while.
I was thinking
while.
Maybe your plane was delayed, and that's why you were late.
No, my apologies. Just a simple time difference. So, anyway.
Oh,
good to hear you guys.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hey, Di.
Yeah, hey. Nice to hear
you.
Well,
welcome. I've introduced you, Di, and we've begun the conversation. We're really glad to have you.
Thank you very much, Jared.
Yeah. So we've kind of presenced this idea of integral genius and cosmic creativity, and Jeff has eloquently advocated for a second-tier disposition that has a fundamental faith rather than an ain't-it-awful, hand-wringing orientation. And we're kind of trying to notice where that linkage is between cosmic creativity, integral genius, and the question that animates this series about how human beings can rise to the challenges of this current very intense moment of the whole human species on the planet. And
yeah,
I'd love to hear you.
Yeah, we've been considering this question together over the last year as we prepare for the Integral Spiritual Experience. And part of, I think, why we've elicited this particular theme is precisely because the rate of change in human culture is so dramatic right now. And that for lots of us, we can feel as though somehow that we're out of pace with these kinds of changes. And when the course of evolution has, over however many, billions of years, the universe has been evolving, that it's a fantastically progressive and changeable situation we're in, and how to kind of join with that sense that change is actually part of the way of things, and that when we become conscious of the possibility of participating in that change and bringing our collective awareness to that, that we have the opportunity to actually literally influence the direction of reality. And it's from one perspective, that sounds awfully inflated. And from another perspective, it's just simply the case. I mean, when you look around and see how much influence human beings have right now and what the impacts of the new technologies are. Jeff was telling us the other day that the new iPhone just came out. And I think, Jeff, weren't you saying that the new iPhone has a quality of artificial intelligence that you can speak into it now, and it literally, with the algorithms, examines all the search engines, and then, like in a nanosecond, comes back with a voice-delivered answer to your question? I mean, it's remarkable.
Amazing. Yeah, it's the kind of thing, just to interject quickly, that 3 days after I had it, I thought, how did I live without this?
Right, yeah. And so I think I also heard someone say recently, which I thought was very powerful, he was a geneticist that I happened to be at a social gathering with, and he was saying that what human beings are starting to learn about the genetic code in his belief system, in his way of seeing, is literally as dramatic to our future as when life came out of the sea. That's literally how important he thinks the discoveries related to the genetic code are. So at this point in time, it just seems really, really important for us to actually receive and participate in this creativity with a joyful mind. And I really, as you were saying, Terry, and Jeff was pointing to, it doesn't negate the fact that creativity also has there's always a destructive element to creativity, that death is a part of our reality, that impermanence permeates our experience. And so we engage this creativity with that understanding, and at the same time to experience ourselves as active participants is a very different disposition than to imagine that we're just simply, because we are the cosmos itself. And not only that, we are the living capacity of the cosmos to reflect on itself, to see itself. And that's an amazing position to be in. And bringing more spiritual awakening to all of these innovations that are happening to me seems very important. So creativity and spirituality are not actually separate from each other. And that's part of what we'll be obviously exploring at the Integral Spiritual Experience.
Yeah. Well, in a way, this is maybe a moment to segue into talking about that a little bit more. I think as we came together to help design it, part of what we began to realize is that there is there are some fundamental structures to how the pattern that already exists, that's carried forward from the past, and the potential for real novelty, that creative leap to a higher order rather than a degeneration toward chaos or simply a repetition of the past, how that comes into being, and that there's an architecture in a way in the subtle and causal dimensions to that creativity, and that by coming together as people who are sincerely holding these deep questions that are personal questions about our own creativity and collective questions about how we can actually unlock the game and change the dynamic of our world in some really important ways, that by coming together in that inquiry, something can be liberated if people who are really sincere and really awake and have a certain kind of liberation from that hand-wringing problematic orientation, but who are still spiritually deep and sober and awake to their mortality and the universality of loss. That there's something in that we space, in that communal space, that can be profoundly uplifting to us each. And I think, at least, you know, I'm kind of articulating my feeling about it. This is an inspiring thing, and to actually design an event where hundreds of people from all over the world get together to lean into that with one another and to cross-pollinate and catalyze that creative edge in one another, that's such an inspiring possibility. And I just want to invite you guys to express your own feelings about that and about how that event even has relevance to these themes as universal themes.
Yeah, well, we're going to be working with them directly. And I think we have a really terrific group of teachers. We have Decker Kunov, who's really one of the, you know, young up-and-coming teachers in the integral evolutionary space who started AMP. And we have Barbara Marks Hubbard. And we have Andrew Cohen's going to be there. And Alex Gray. And, you know, Sophia Diaz. And, you know, a real...
And Michael real Dowd, big, too.
Yeah. And Michael Dowd, yeah. A great cast of characters who are, you know, really in the evolutionary world space.
And Ken
Wilber. Pardon me?
And Ken Wilber.
And Ken Wilber, yeah, absolutely. And Ken, and this is something to share, I think, on this call is a little preview of some of the actual teaching that Ken has come up with for on this cosmic creativity. And just as you say, Terry, the architecture between the gross, subtle, and causal when it comes to actually practicing creativity and coming up with something that is actually a vision for your life or a calling or even a problem or a project and holding it in your mind and bearing it in mind, as Ken says, just bearing it in mind while you get in touch with the subtle energies that are arising around that and the dream images that may be coming in or what you hear in conversation with other people. And this is where other people come in handy for this kind of thing, because you really get a sort of a multiplier effect when you really allow your dream and vision to be seen by other people. It's something. It's really powerful. And many of us never really do that very well or never get an opportunity to do that as a practice. And then to, in a way, turn the whole project over to God and to rest in the open awareness itself or the open space or emptiness of absolute reality and sort of let go and relax and become receptive to the animating energetics that are running the whole show, the energetics of love and intelligence and sanity that actually is the qualities of the space that we live in and the space of our own being. I mean, it's sane. You know, we're basically good, sane, you know, intelligent, loving creatures in a universe that has the same qualities. We have to have some faith in that. And I do. And I think others do as they contact it. And then to move back into a more concrete revisioning of the project or of the problem or of the calling or the mission or the vision of your life, and to prototype it and to make concrete probes into the reality where you test this and that and take the risk. Sometimes, you know, there's no testing. You just got to jump over the chasm. And, you know, to just do all of this with more on board, with more online, with your body online, with your spirit online, and that there is a real multiplier effect there that brings on, you know, not only effectiveness and power, but wisdom that really, kind of supercharges the whole thing. And I think Ken is extra credible on this because he himself, and we're talking Ken Wilber here, of course, is a creative giant in our midst. I mean, his contribution, his original creative contribution to humanity is historic. And in my opinion, not yet fully appreciated. And so it's, it's just, my goodness, what a privilege to work with him on this in ways that are that really operationalize it in a way that, you know, I've been around this scene for a long time, and it's new to me. And it feels like cutting-edge not only theory, but practice. And so, you know, I guess I'd stop there. See, Di, what you're thinking about it.
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm, of course, reflecting a lot on what you said, and there's some, you know, powerful, just powerful invitations in what you were talking about in terms of how we practice, how we engage our body, mind, spirit, how we engage each other, how we sort of joyfully participate in the unfolding of this life, and particularly at this time of our collective, you know, the community of integralists, and also the quality of seniors, you know, that we actually need each other in order to develop and to create and participate in the evolutionary impulse fully. And I think for me that part of what I'm looking forward to is the invitation to invite participants to really engage their relationship to their own creativity. Because a lot of us are estranged due to our enculturation or our upbringing or the context in which we grew up, not to kind of have our full permission to be as creative as we are. So part of what we're going to be doing almost is inviting people to look at their own relationship to their life motivation and to their creative impulses and to
Di, are you there?
Yeah, connect to their motivations, and also to, did I blank out for a minute, Terry?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry about that. So anyway, what I'm saying is that I just am interested in people being able to connect to their own creativity and really see themselves as creative beings. And one of the things we know about creative people is that they believe they're creative, that they're, and they are happy to be who they are, and they are happy to live in this moment. They're not, you know, tortured by the past or fretting about the future, but they're fully inhabiting their life. And so we want to really, you know, investigate that and look at what our belief systems around our own creativity are and see if there are ways we can liberate that and really give ourselves permission to engage more fundamentally with the creative impulse.
Yeah.
And
I think one thing I would add to that, just coming up in real time, is that it also gives us an opportunity to, in a way, as we're sort of raising the bar on our own creativity, to, in a way, lower it.
yeah.
terms of, well, you know, I mean, I think that we sort of all still are waking out of the dream of orange, of, you know, of achievement, that we all have to make some big impact.
Right.
And I think, you know, for a lot of people, the move forward is to actually bring it in a little bit and say, you know what, I'm going to have a great garden this year, or I'm going to be the best grandparent I could possibly be, or, you know, I'm just going to, you know, sweep the floor of my little kitchen, so to speak, you know, work in my community and be the non-anxious, loving, wise presence that people find so appealing about integral consciousness. And, you know, I think that that's, I feel myself relax when I sort of give myself a little break in terms of, you know, what's the actual impact.
Well, yeah, I mean, you're making an important point, which is, you know, how does the notion of success or, you know, some more extreme level of excellence, how does that get mixed into our creativity? Because really joining with the eros of who we are and with the freshness of each moment and with our capacity to interact with reality and to bring new and innovative things into being, I'm not quite sure how it is that we, maybe it is due to passing through orange, where we mix that up with somehow being measured according to some standard, when really,
yes,
you know, children are naturally very creative, and they're not
yes,
sitting back holding themselves to some sort of, you know, standard approval by everybody around them. And I think you're right, that at some point that does enter into our experience and it does put a damper on our creativity. So how do we both engage the fresh, energetic, and very innate impulse of humans to be creative and bring enough discipline to it that there's some quality of excellence without burdening ourselves with some idea that we have to, you know, be somebody?
Right. Hallelujah.
It's interesting to hold both the deepest intention and care for the whole and to also completely relax any artificial grandiosity or ambition and to be able to simply be who we are without letting, because each of those positions has a false side. Like there's a falsity to that we're already articulating to the overarching evolutionary ambition that we have to move evolution forward and that each of us has to somehow rise to some kind of grandiose role. That's not healthy. But it's also possible to take that more sort of permissive and fully accepting orientation so far that we cease to be enlivened by our connectivity to, you know, we're connected to everything and in some sense the world really does need our highest and best contribution, and in doing that we really are part of the health of the whole human system and part of its capacity to manifest a healthy adaptive response in a time that is obviously an inflection point in our process in which rapid and powerful and wise and loving innovation is really called for, and to honor that and to feel deeply connected to all of that without falling into a problematic orientation, so that somehow this is an enduring polarity in which there are truths and potentially falsehoods on both sides, it seems.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's right. And I think it's actually the point of practice for a lot of us is how can we do what you just said, Terry? Be engaged, passionate, caring, effective, disciplined, getting off our butts, taking risks, you know, having a little fire lit under us. And also not be gripped and angry and blaming and, you know, full of some sort of idea that this has gone horribly wrong and there's something wrong with me that I can't do more to fix it, which is the state that so many of us find ourselves in, especially at Green. And so I actually think it's my practice. You know, I know I can locate all of what I just said in my own mind, body on any given moment. And I just work with it. And, you know, sometimes some days better than others, frankly.
I'm curious how this is landing and reflecting through your mind-body, Di.
Well, you know, I was thinking as you were both talking about that, I was just thinking about some of the ways that service is being done in the world now and the ways that nonprofits are beginning to operate. I think that, you know, as we start to mature and move out of the, you know, kind of position of desperateness in a certain way that Jeff's describing, that we actually do have a possibility of, you know, bringing a kind of joyful and playful and, you know, like engaging with the challenges of the world doesn't need to make us heavy-hearted. You know, there's actually a possibility that we can do it in ways that are innately joyful, even though, you know, we have some serious challenges ahead of us and some difficulty. You know, the problems of poverty, of economic justice, of, you know, the arms trade and racial and ethnic strife, these are serious issues in the, you know, climate change and just the stresses on the natural world. These are, you know, these are big collective problems. But we also are kind of, you know, as we can learn how to engage our heart and our joy in relation, and our, you know, in the the innovations we're talking about, which really each and every one of them are divine gifts. I mean, all these ideas spring out of nowhere. Everything we're experiencing came from nothing, and we don't really know how. It just sprung up. And so I feel that, like, there's a beautiful opportunity for us to learn to engage the difficulty. And I think people who are deeply practiced have learned how to do that all along, but that's what practice brings to this.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Right on. Yeah, well put.
Yeah, really well put. And in doing that together, like in a scene like the integral, evolutionary, non-dual, post-traditional, trans-rational, different spiritual communities that in many ways are converging, is there a way that our individual practice along those lines comes together and something changes because of the way that it's coming together? And are these conscious gatherings, like this really big one we're going to be doing over New Year's, December 28th to January 1st, how can that play a role, and how can that maybe even catalyze something that deserves? Yeah, I'd be curious for you to keep going, Guy, and take that into the we space more fully.
Well, as I said, the challenges that we're facing are not, I mean, we all have our individual challenges. We all have our challenges, you know, to our smaller groups and communities. But the big challenge is that as we are participating in more world-centric activity with more global awareness, that these are huge collective challenges. So in some ways, learning how to do this together is precisely where our cutting edge is. And it's the place where our spiritual practice and creativity are one, precisely because our practices have always been pointing us towards more cooperation, more loving kindness, you know, more patience with one another, more shared fearlessness in terms of working together. And what I love about the integral world, and I always have, is that there's an incredible amount of diversity in this particular scene. You know, we have people who are sustainability experts, who are organizational development people. We have physicists, we have painters, we have, you know, spiritual practitioners and athletes. And it's a beautiful, wonderfully diverse mix of people. And yet there is a kind of willingness to work together, to collaborate together, to try different things, to push up against one another. And in some ways, the challenges, some of the people I know in the world who live in intentional community, and they get to practice in a certain way with more depth because they live together, they do a shared project together, and they can really take some of this collective work and collective intelligence to really deep levels. But the integral community has a little bit less depth at this stage, but a lot of span in terms of being able to call on one another for particular kinds of expertise or insight. And I've talked about how in my own life, you know, on one end of the spectrum, I've had people in the recovery world support my family, you know, when I've had a nephew with a drug addiction, and Integral Friends in South Africa helped me get him into a recovery program. And on the other hand, you know, I've called on organizational development people to help me design projects, and sustainability people to help me think about certain things. So there's just, I love the fact that you can just kind of call up a friend in the integral scene and you know, access a whole kind of intelligence, you know. In other words, together our intelligence is really broad and really, there's a lot of span to it. And there's a lot of international presence. There's people all over the world who are practicing integral. So it's a very, I mean, the word seamless really rings for me because I really feel it in this group of people. So the event for me is about actually working with that cutting edge and seeing how, even though we may not be working in intentional community, we are networked, and that this global network, that there's a tremendous amount of resources that's available, and that learning how to collaborate and as Jeff was saying, bring our body, our speech, our mind into the same state to work together. And I'm looking forward to doing that over this 5 days. And I enjoy it with the two of you all the time.
Yeah. This is interesting as I'm feeling into this. I feel like we've really, really hit a lot of the notes in this conversation, that we've kind of presenced this inherent creativity that the whole cosmos is, that the miraculous nature of the present moment and the miraculous nature of the most ancient moment, the moment of the Big Bang, the miraculous nature of the moments in which the first light-sensitive cells began to evolve, the beginnings of the first eye, or the moments in which sea life began to venture into the terrestrial environment, or the moments in which human culture began to change because we had stable settlements that grew their food, and therefore we had way more cultural exchanges per day and week and month. That this newness, these important moments in which this whole evolutionary process has manifested something new, it's right here in this moment right now. And that in our actually becoming fully present with one another, good friends who've worked this territory for a while, who've laid down some patterns, who've had a chance to fall in love with each other and to fight and to make up and to grow and to create and to debrief it, that right here, right now, the potential for radical newness is here, and that there's something in the humility, like the silence, the waiting, the openness, the trust and faith and relaxation of our beings in connection with some amazing and beautiful future that is wanting to find its way into form through us, and our fidelity to that and to one another, to the very moment we're in right now, all simultaneously, it somehow is a field in which something is right now new, and something right now might become alive in some way we've never seen. And that this kind of innocent beginner's mind, childlike expectancy and willingness that is us being that field of receptivity and willingness to bend our knee to serve something greater than ourselves, and all of that together are a presence right here, right now. And that feeling that and being that together, and perhaps inviting everyone who's listening to us to enter into that field with us, and just personally, this is maybe important to bring forward. That's what I'm feeling moved. I think I should be phrasing this as a question. I guess it is. It's an invitation just to be with me in that. You guys have anything to offer or respond?
No, beautiful, Terry. I'm open for questions whenever you are.
Yeah, whenever you are, Terry.
Okay, well, good. We'll take our break now. So if you have a question for Diane and or Jeff or me, please type it into the window if you're tuned in via computer, the instant teleseminar window on your computer. And if you've dialed in by phone, please press *2 on your keypad, and that'll raise your hand, and I can call on you for a live question.
And we want
now,
to hear
for those
you.
Of you – Well, we're almost We're almost at the time of the break anyway, Jeff. I think it's time to do this break in any case, and we can continue with the questions from them, and we can keep bouncing it around among the three of us as well.
Cool.
Well, first of all, if you'd like more exposure to Diane's work, I want you to know that she has a lovely website, DianeMuschoHamilton.com. And if you'd like to know more about Jeff and his work, you can find out about his weekly blog at dailyevolver.com or his periodic integral incubators at integralincubator.com. And I also want to invite you all to a very special free offering that I've just created. It's a little different from many of my other teachings, which tend to focus on the positive aspects of the life of practice. In this one, I focus on some of the pitfalls that many of us face in our attempt to live a more integral and evolutionary life. And even if you're doing many things right, a handful of subtle obstructions that you might be overlooking can thwart the full benefits of practice. And so these blocks, you know, show up as myths that we subconsciously believe that act to undermine our conscious evolution. So by bringing awareness to them, I think you can begin to undo them and free up energy for greater forward momentum. So that's why I've created a free teleclass called The Five Spiritual Myths That Sabotage Your Conscious Evolution. And I'll be doing that live this Tuesday. If you miss that, that'll be Tuesday at 5:30 Pacific time. But if you miss that, you can download it. If you register, just go to ispseminar.com, ispseminar.com, and you can register for free. And finally, and in a way most important, I want to invite you to consider attending the Integral Spiritual Experience event that Diane and Jeff and I are helping to design. And you've been hearing about that. The theme is cosmic creativity, and it will be an embodiment of integral genius. So it's really designed to be a place where you can experience everything we've been talking about here, and it'll be taking place at Asilomar, which is a really beautiful conference grounds right on the Pacific coast near Monterey, California. It'll begin in the evening of December 28th, and it'll end on New Year's Day, January 1st. And as you might have heard, it features philosopher Ken Wilber, futurist Barbara Marks Hubbard, visionary artist Alex Gray, evolutionary enlightenment teacher Andrew Cullen, evolutionary evangelist Michael Dowd, creativity and relationship experts Gay and Katie Hendricks, gonzo musician, artist, and comedian Stuart Davis, Decker Kanov, Sophia Diaz, Samuel Bondurge, and Paul Roshi, many other amazing people. And it'll be really an amazing gathering of the Integral Tribe and a truly amazing way to ring in 2012. So you can do that by going to integralspiritualexperience.com to find out more. And as a listener to Beyond Awakening, you can save $100 on the registration cost by using the discount code BEYOND, B-E-Y-O-N-D, when you register. And please stay on the line, and at the very end of this call, after the next half hour of questions and answers, I'll tell you a little more about what's going to be coming up with our next couple of guests, neuropsychologist Rick Hansen and Buddhist geek Vincent Horn. And then we'll open up the line so we can hear some of each other's voices as we say goodbye. Okay. Let's see. We've got several live and typed in questions. Eric Allady, hello Eric, from Paris, says, great talk, guys. What does characterize the formation of a genius? Is it the equivalent of a holon? Should its members need first to transcend their egos in order to make it alive?
Wow.
Yeah, that's a good question. Eric is actually a quite masterful organizational design consultant. What do you think about that?
Well, I'd take a stab at it. And that is that a group of people is not a holon. It's what Ken Wilber would call a social holon. It's made up of holons. So while it has some characteristics of, you know, one mind and one will and even one body in certain ways, certainly subtle, it's not technically considered a holon. So that's the quick answer to that. But one of the things that does indeed, I think, characterize genius is a certain dropping of the ego, in the sense that one is not motivated when one goes into this kind of a container or this kind of an interpersonal space to be seen in the ways that we're used to wanting to be seen. Our opinions are less important. We really do. There's a little bit of the St. Francis prayer in there where we really do make it our job to understand more than to be understood. We may not be looking for the perfect answer. We're looking to move the ball because as evolutionaries, we know that the answer is evolving. The answer is unfolding. And so we're not looking for some perfect stable state, which is what first-tier worldviews are all about. And so we relax that, and we are truly in exploration together in a way that keeps a certain part of our hearts and bellies open, and minds for sure, and eyes, and hands, and loins, you know, the whole bit, all the chakras, open in a way that is not typical when we're in first-tier structures. So I throw that into the fire there.
That was beautiful, Jeff. You know, Di, what do you think about, I mean, maybe the Cevious becomes something really radically different when
thinking about it a little bit. And I would say this also. I mean, I think that we talk about center of gravity, and that basically I think what, like good jazz musicians, that the music is much more interesting than anybody's individual personality, which is not to say that at any moment somebody might not have an egoic contraction or get bent out of shape, but it just it's just insignificant in relationship to what actually matters and what's going on. So being able to include the small self, you know, as individual part holes, and but at the same time not to be organized around those moments of contraction or disappointment or whatever it is. So I like to imagine that we include and go beyond, and also include that there are moments of small egoic business, but that we don't spend too much time there, not enough to even make it important. So.
Mm. Yeah, I think an example we can use, and it's something that it's not exclusive to second tier by any means in terms of the state experience, and that is the experience of being in a happen and intersubjective space. And two examples I would think of would be one is a jazz band or a musical group where you are indeed joining a single moment together where the music is more important than any particular contribution, and yet, as you say, Di, somebody can have a solo, somebody can shine, somebody can, you know, really step out within that container and be sparkly and seen in a whole new way, even than they could alone. And that's also true in a sports team.
Yeah,
where
absolutely.
You know, the team works together, and then sometimes somebody gets to be a star. And this is good practice for people. And anybody who is a good team player or in a band that actually works, I mean, that's just terrific practice in seniors in general. And that's, as I say, certainly not limited to second tier.
And one of the things that we're going to talk about, the integral spiritual experience, is we're going to talk about the context of creativity, about seniors. Another way to talk about seniors is creativity in all four quadrants. Because Brian Eno makes the point that no really highly creative person exists in a vacuum. They always exist in a content of thought or of cultural innovation or of mathematical cutting edge. There's always a context. There's always a cultural discourse. There are always influences. There are always critics. And the times have a lot to do with why something really reaches a certain pinnacle of excellence in a certain way. So that's going to be one of our points of exploration is the way in which genius is another way to say creativity in all four quadrants.
Yes.
Beautiful. Well, you know, I love what you guys have said. There's one piece of what Eric asked that I don't think we responded to quite as fully that I'd like to say one thing about, which is...
Yeah, go for it.
The idea that with the transcendence of ego, there might be something else that can go on in genius. And I know that for me, it's one of the presenting questions that was part of how I came to even found this series was the sense, I remember actually years and years ago, Gangaji was a helpful person to me during the years when I was kind of arriving more fully outside just the community around my teacher, Adi Da. And I went to several of her satsangs and was just so delighted at the open field that she had created. But at a certain point, I stood up and asked a question at one of these fairly large satsangs. I think it was a gathering of maybe 400 people or so. And I asked her, okay, at a certain point when we do wake up, what is it that we do? We certainly don't all then go out and do what you're doing. It isn't as though our enlightenment should be used by us all sitting in the big chair and answering questions or convening satsang meetings. There must be something else that an enlightened society becomes. I think that this sense that there is the beginning of, that there are more and more people who are spending, who are touching and tasting a possibility where they really do stand outside ego. And in that place, they feel, we feel, a potential to participate from a whole different relationship to life, a whole different context, a whole different presumption. And we can be effective and powerful in many different, you know, such, so importantly differently by working together and operating in connection with one another than we can alone. But there is, I think, a trans-egoic dimension to what's emerging. And I don't think that we should say that senius is only this trans-egoic expression, but there is one that is an important flavoring or inspiration or provocation to something more general. And that even in the moments when we haven't transcended ego, and even in the moments, and even people who have no experience of fully transcending ego, the sense of being connected to communities of people who really are operating from a very radically transpersonal place is really a big deal, and it's a big important part of what's evolving right now. And I think that this trans-egoic potential is an element in this integral evolutionary seeingness that's pretty important. And so by pointing to it, I think Eric is serving this consideration in a way that I value and just wanted to acknowledge and maybe highlight.
Right on.
Yeah, well, I think it's also just a tremendous pleasure. I mean, it's a real pleasure just to work in a group of people who are innovating and creating and working together. And I just don't want to give the impression that, you know, if you experience certain kinds of holding, egoic holding, or moments of that in a group, that you're not in the right place. I'm kind of coming on the side of, you know, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater in terms of thinking that it's an indication something's wrong. But that the water that everyone's swimming in is for the most part free of a lot of that. That's been my experience. So.
Yeah, beautiful. Well put. And in a very, very important qualifying, you know, that distinction is so crucial. You know, I think it's a compassionate and important distinction to make the space truly welcoming and free, too. So thank you, Ty.
Well, and also that you depend on your friends in a certain way, you know, because the one thing about, you know, those moments of fixation is they, you know, it's hard to know how you're experiencing them on your interior, but, you know, for sure, when your friends all agree, it's time for you to let go.
That's right. That reminds me of your favorite line about, what is it, about a horse's ass, I think. How does it go, Doc? Yeah.
It says, it goes into, from where, my upbringing. If a person says that you're a horse's ass, forget about it. If two people say that you are, think about it. And if three people say you're a horse's ass, get yourself a saddle. You know, in any kind of moment of seniors, you might be told to get yourself a saddle.
Well, we have a live question here from Denver. Phone number is a 720-883 exchange. You are unmuted.
That would be me. Hi, this is Melanie. Wow, thank you so much. Jeff, you're a fabulous pastor.
Oh, thanks, Ellen.
I feel like I've been to church. This is wonderful. You know, somebody told me recently that I was very intelligent, and they didn't mean that as a compliment. And trying to fix the mess that I've messes I've made in my life has been like plowing a field with a pair of tweezers. So I really appreciate the reminder to keep it simple. I've used my creativity in a way to complicate what solutions might be there for me. It got to be a lifestyle. It was fun to find all these creative ways to survive. And I really appreciate the reminder to just keep it simple. And I wanted to mention Jonas Salk wrote a book in the mid-80s called Anatomy of Reality, The Convergence of Tuition and Reason. And it's amazing how it's all about what we're talking about. And the main thing is being self-correcting. That will save our species. And, you know, forgiving ourselves is evolutionarily sound. And I saw a poster once for a Twilight movie that said, when we live forever, what do we live for? And when I play with that feeling tone of, wow, I'm here and I'm in partnership with this evolutionary impulse, it's a wonderful sense of not making up goals, but really like a goal to accomplish. But it's a whole other way to think about just, I get that my purpose is just to be here and to be here to evolve consciousness and to say thank you and to enjoy it. Just to enjoy it. Mm-hmm. Keep it simple and just say thank you. And I say thank you to all you guys. I so much appreciated the conference, the month-long conference. It helped me to relax my judgments of a lot of other people's perspectives, and to even have the, what a relief just to have the concept of, oh, you know, a perspective on a perspective on a perspective. It's a wonderful relaxing of condemnation and judgment on my part of other people's ways of thinking and being. And anyway, I'm grateful to you guys.
Thank you
so much. Lots of love and blessings to you.
Thank you.
Yes, thanks, Melanie.
Okay. let me bring in some of the other questions that we have. We have quite a few rich ones. Andreas Schroeder from Rügen, Germany asks, are there characteristics to identify cosmic creativity and integral senius results to separate, let's see, that separate it from other creativity results, or the results of such creativity, to separate that from the results of creativity driven by my ego or some of my small selves?
Well, I would just observe that I'm not sure that all creativity in some ways accesses what we're talking about. And that is that, you know, if you think of the creativity of Mozart or of Shakespeare or of Lennon and McCartney or of anybody who, you know, their creativity is just, you know, undeniable, and that they brought forth something new into the world, that that is always has some quality of the numinous to it. It has some quality of the light of God or of absolutely reality shining into the world. And so in that way, I'm not sure that it's any different. It's just intrinsically delicious. It's intrinsically fulfilling. And it just is, it's a portal into human genius. What would be distinctive about the second tier is that it's just simply that we know it in a way that is perhaps new. And, just as with the dawning of self-consciousness, life comes to know itself, with the dawning of second-tier consciousness, in a way, evolution or the procreant urge of the universe, of the cosmos, begins to know itself. And that is a new knowing. And so we were talking yesterday with Ken Wilber about, claims that various developmentalists make that integral consciousness is multiple times, 10 times more effective than previous stages of consciousness. And if indeed that's true, it's simply because of that at Integral we have the ability to take so many more perspectives and not just take them in the way that we might at Green, but to receive them, to become antenna for them, to actually embody them and to be able to get behind the eyes of other people in a way that we couldn't before. And then also that there is a quality of evolution knowing itself, and that we actually realize that we are evolving creatures in an evolving world, and we have a capital R realization of that, that just is breathtaking in a way that we realize now for the first time as human beings that we are in a co-creator situation, that we are actually working with Almighty God to move the ball here, and we, for the first time, really know it.
Yeah,
beautiful.
I think that's beautiful. Yeah. And, just this capacity to take perspectives, the more perspectives we can take, the more creativity is available to us. I think that was an important point that you made and that Ken made yesterday.
Yeah.
And,
yeah, it's something. We're working it through. We're learning this as we go. And I get a little frothy and confused here myself. But, gosh, what a great problem. What a high class problem to be sorting this out. And everybody in this call or listening to this call is in that game one way or the other.
I think that Andreas, your question is a rich one, because what you're noticing is that there's much greater degrees of freedom that are when that creativity is able to be sourced in something that is self-transcending. And I think that sometimes that feels like such a radical shift that it's important to kind of create a category. There's that lower kind of creativity where there's a lot of self-involvement and conflict and angst and kind of ego all tied up with it. And then there's something that seems to flow in a much freer way, and it seems worthwhile to make a distinction between those two types of creativity. Whereas I think that if you look at it most radically, you see that the true creativity that arises in anyone is a moment in which that aperture opens up, and that which transcends the individual really flows through. That real creativity is the creativity of the cosmos, not the creativity of an ego. Even though someone who's very egoic and complicated might occasionally or even maybe regularly be able to open up into that kind of open vessel kind of orientation where that greater creativity can flow through. But I think that the seamless is a space in which the greater thing is appreciated and valued, in which some common understandings and common languages and common clarities are a foundation, so that people are, in a sense, rooting on that greater creative flow with one another, sensing a kind of shared, it's kind of like when I see the whole integral scene becoming healthier and accomplishing good things, I feel as if I did some of that, even if it wasn't my personal creativity. And I root for it. I cheer it on. There's a certain way in which my prayer to be used by God is operating for Jeff and for Diane and for all these people who I value and am connected with. And that sense of shared connectedness to that creativity, that does make it a seamless rather than just the personal experience of transcendence. It's a shared holding or shared midwifing of something bigger than ourselves. And yet I don't think that a radical distinction between the transegoic and the egoic ends up being where we hang. We're just appreciating that which is manifesting more than anything else. That's my personal sense of it.
And I can also, you know, maybe become extremely creative in terms of a line of development, like my musical talent, and really be able to play from a transcendent, in a transcendent space. And then when I have to deal with my other members of my orchestra on a daily basis, I may not be quite so, my social skills might not be as developed as my musical skills.
Right. Right.
Yeah, and that's okay.
Right. We have another
one.
Go ahead, Terry.
Well, I was just going to say real quickly that we just have, we not only befriend everybody in the field, we befriend the parts of ourselves that, you know, we're kind of like outside the borders. And that is, you know, a beautiful thing as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Good. Well, we have another live caller from Joliet, Illinois, who I've just unmuted, I think. Unterschutz,
That's me.
Hi.
Hi, my name's Phyllis.
Please introduce yourself and let us know your question.
My name is Phyllis. You got the last name right. You must have some German blood flowing through you there, huh? To say Unterschutz correctly. I was particularly taken with, I believe it was, I've been taking notes, so I don't know who said everything, but I believe it was Jeff that said that when you tell people that things are getting better, even your liberal friends, people may get angry because there's a fear of letting go of fear, believing that fear is what motivates us. And if we don't have fear and anger, what's going to keep us going? And this, that really, really struck me. The work that I do, my husband and I and a partner, we do work in racial healing. And we've been doing this work for quite a long time, although I'm new to this particular forum here through the Shift Network. And I've been listening just now for the past couple months. I've been listening to these teleseminars and realizing how completely in line we are, the work that we've been doing, how completely in line that is with what you're talking about. Because our whole process is evolutionary. We come from the point of view of our oneness. And we're looking at race and racism as a stage that we've been going through as humanity that has now become such a source of illness to us as a human family that there's kind of a common understanding that we need to grow past this. But we don't know how to grow past it. And so with our partner, we do presentations and workshops and so forth talking about racial healing. We focus pretty much on black and white because our partner's black and my husband and I are white. But we use that then as a core teaching to talk about any either racial separation or any other separation that's come about as a result of some kind of prejudice or conditioning. And one of the things we come up against most often is that people do not want to let go of the fear and anger around racial injustice because they believe that that's the only thing powerful enough to motivate workers in this field of eliminating racism. And when we talk about the power of love and attraction, they think that's too namby-pamby wishy-washy. So I would really like to hear your input on that.
Yeah. Well, what I would say is that first of all, God bless you for the work you're doing, and you're helping. You're part of the solution. I appreciate it. We all do. And I think that part of it is we need to tell some new stories. Period. About ourselves as human beings. And one of the stories we can tell, and one of the things that we can see actually from an integral perspective, is that, you know, just basic integral theory human beings move from egocentric to ethnocentric to world-centric to cosmocentric. That's one developmental scheme that we use. And that for particularly the more developed countries, we're moving from ethnocentric to world-centric. And so mm-hmm. there's just a natural move where, and you can see it in this election, in fact, that it's one of the strange emergence of this election is that the most conservative people in America are supporting a black man, Herman Cain.
Right.
And one of the things that shows, and it's good news, it shows that actually memes or developmental levels trump race. Actually, we feel more close to people at our developmental level than we do with people from other races that are people from our own race that are at different developmental levels.
And also, Obama is also a minority elected by a white majority. You know.
Mm-hmm.
That's important to notice also.
Yeah, so we can just see and tell the story that this is getting better. Now, that's a story that you're going to run into, as I pointed out, great resistance to, because people are afraid of letting go of their anger, for one thing, and also it requires that they let go of some piece of their identity. Because if their identity is that I've been a victim or perpetrator, that's a tough one to let go of, but that's
right.
The work we're doing.
And also within that, because I've also done work with racism as a mediator and a person who used to facilitate a lot of dialogues and do race bias workshops and cultural competency and whatnot. And I think with working within the groups and also being able to recognize the state developmental differences, so the group may be between ethnocentric and world-centric, and world-centric people are basically stepping out of this really strong division where difference is threatening and into a place where difference is actually interesting, and that's a huge bright line. But again, within any community, you can have state stages of development, like Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, where you can have people who are in denial, you can have people who are angry, you can have people who are bargaining, people who are depressed, and people who are actually all the way have moved through all those different states and are now at a place of acceptance and can hold the complexity. So there's a collective kind of ethnocentric/world-centric, and then any individual might be in a different emotional state stage depending on who they are. And so using a developmental model really helps with those kind of discussions I've discovered.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I think I've noticed that a lot of times the greatest resistance to this idea that we are evolving into something new comes from people that are actively working in an institution where racism is killing people. You know,
yeah.
These are people that are, you know, maybe in social services, in communities that are so impacted by racism, or maybe they're in the prison system, or we have a lot of friends that are working in black neighborhoods as social workers, and they say, yeah, this is all well and good, but in the meantime, while you're there working on evolution, you know, I've lost six more clients to to violence or to racism, you know, and it's not happening fast enough, and the only thing that's going to change, they hope the thing that will change the system in their neighborhood quickly is rage at the injustice, you know.
Well, I think that I would want to enter into deep relationship with that person, but I don't think that I would end up wanting to accede to their analysis. I want to offer compassion and respect, but not necessarily to...
It's an appropriate
hold that both things are true, and that's one of the things that we can do and we can practice with as integralists, is to see that both of these stories are true. There is pernicious racism afoot, and things are getting better. So, you know, that's not something that everybody can deeply hold.
Well, thank you, Phyllis. That enriched our conversation. I think we want to go into that more deeply, certainly personally, even if not during this time. We're pretty much at the end of our time, but there are a number of rich questions from people in, gosh, Toronto and St. Augustine and Provo, and I'm sorry we're not going to be able to get to all of them, but there's one from Tom in New York where he asks, how can we embody this cosmic creativity and feel it in the body so that we can express from there? I wanted to invite you, Di, since you often draw people into these kind of state experiences, to help us finish off this call with maybe a chance for everybody to drop in and be led into a guided process of cosmic creativity.
Well, for those of us who do this in the context of spiritual practice, we talk about two dimensions. And one dimension to our practice is the fundamental state of being, or the ground of being, which is can also include the unmanifest, is the unmanifest side of the street in which all of reality is still and silent and open and free of urgency, free of need, complete, perfect. Everything is just as it is. And from that place, we can also contact something that does move, that actually is located on the time bound side of the street. And we start to feel that in that side of our experience, or that dimension of our experience, that there's an excitement. And if we really touch into it, we see that there, the quality of passion, of urgency, and you might even say almost an ecstatic joy. But just to feel into the becoming side of who we are, in which there's something passionate that wants to move, that wants to be expressed, that wants to come into form, and to really just contact that part of you that has something really deep that wants to be expressed, and to somehow be able to live in both those both dimensions of our existence.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, Di. Well, it looks like we're out of time. So thank you, everybody. And before I tell you what's coming up next week and we open up the lines to say goodbye, just a few reminders. If you value what you're receiving here, please let others know about it. They can register for it at beyondawakeningseries.com. And if you appreciate what Diane has communicated, you can visit her website, dianemushohamilton.com, and Jeff's website, dailyevolver.com. And you're very warmly invited to my upcoming free teleseminar on the five spiritual myths that can sabotage your conscious evolution. You just go to ISP, like Integral Spiritual Practice, ispseminar.com. You're also invited to the Integral Spiritual Experience at Asilomar that we've been talking about. And that's going to be quite a gathering of the Integral Evolutionary Tribe. It's really the premier gathering, and we expect close to 300 people in a beautiful place, December 28th to January 1st. Please check it out at integralspiritualexperience.com. And remember that you can get $100 off your registration by using the discount code BEYOND, B-E-Y-O-N-D. 2 weeks from today, on Sunday, November 27th, neuropsychologist Rick Hansen will be joining me for a dialogue on the brain of a Buddha, on what the neurological foundations of that Buddhist enlightenment really are. And then on December 11th, I'll be joined by Buddhist geek Vincent Horn for a geek's eye view of the future of spiritual practice. And please stay tuned. I'll be announcing more events for 2012. And now, thank you so much for joining Jeff and Diane and me today. Please, let's open up our phone lines so we can hear each other's voices and say goodbye.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Goodbye.
Goodbye, bye. Everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. Yay. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Thanks very much.
Okay.